Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and today I am joined by Peter Turow, and we are talking all about Sleeping Beauties, which Stephen King co-wrote with his son, Owen. You know, he's not collaborating with Joe Hill here, so we're getting a little different family dynamic. Peter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And is there anything you quickly want to let our listeners know about you since this is your first time on the podcast?
Probably just, you know, I've been a Stephen King reader for a very, very long time. My problem is I tend to read a bunch of his stuff all in a row. And then I sort of feel like that sort of helps me get a nice little vibe for him and what I like and what I don't like about his writing.
Yeah. For you, was this a first read, a reread for the podcast? For me personally, it was a first read and I had no idea what the story was about going into it.
Very much the same. First read, and I made a point to not really know anything about it till I got into it.
Yeah, I actually picked up the comic adaptation because that just came out this year and I was like, okay, I'm almost to the book. I cannot open this. You know, it's going straight on the shelf. I'm not going to look at it, not going to dive into that at all. And I was very intrigued by the concept behind this book. But as I was getting into it, it definitely felt like it was more of an Owen book, I think, than a Stephen King book.
Yeah, this is my first Owen book.
Same.
This reminded me the closest thing of Under the Dome. And, you know, Stephen King's worst impulses, I think, are to create a really interesting dynamic with his characters in the beginning. I always get really, like, engaged in the world that he builds, but then he has no idea how to stick the landing at a certain point. And I feel like this one had a bit more measured ending. It happened with a bit more time left in the book than I had expected. And I think that is an Owen influence for sure.
See, I'm glad you brought up Under the Dome, because I think for me, I definitely like, you know, the main portion of Under the Dome more. But for this, I think I liked the ending more than I maybe liked the Under the Dome ending. So that's kind of a pretty good comparison, because these stories, both of them, are really about the people in a specific town and this thing that is happening to the entire town. Granted, you know, Sleeping Beauties, these things are happening all over the world, not just in the town that they're in, which is Dueling. And, you know, both of these books thankfully had character lists at the front of them.
Which I loved. I loved.
Yeah, because there are so many characters. Like, you know, this one is what?
4 pages of characters.
So right off the bat, I knew we were getting something along the lines of an Under the Dome, but the fact that this thing is happening on a massive scale and we're really just focusing on this smaller group of people in comparison, obviously, to the entire world's population, but it was something that got my attention, but it took me so long to get into this story. And I think that's where I could tell that the Owen influences were coming in, because it felt like the premise was there, but the character work just wasn't quite where I wanted it to be.
Yeah, completely. I also didn't expect them to go to the other side. I didn't think we were going to get any of that. And so I was, once the second half of the book started, and that's where we ended up, I was quite, oh, we're going to get the women's side of this. That's good for what it was.
And it's like we did, but at the same time, it felt like, okay, they're just going to start their own thing. And I think what was missing for me was sort of getting to know these people before this big incident happens. Because when you take a look at something like Under the Dome, you still have this big thing happening, but you're still getting to know a lot of backstory with those characters. And granted, that book is still, in fact, longer because it's over 1,000 pages. And this one, thankfully, was not. But when you look at something like It, too, basically any of King's stories with an ensemble, you have a lot of momentum building up with the characters. And I felt like we didn't quite have that here. Did you feel the same way?
I did. And I think that's because, like you said, it all started happening a little too quickly. Like, I wouldn't have minded if 60 pages in, all of this started happening, or 70 pages in. I wanted just a little bit more with everyone, especially since some of the women, I remember we got to the end, I don't know who this person is. You say she's a character. Ostensibly, she's appeared sometime before this. I'm not going to go back to check, but I do feel that. Yeah, it wasn't enough character work. And some of Stephen King's best stuff is when he really does hunker down and get that small town character stuff. I had just read Needful Things last month, and that was my first time reading that. And that was like, to me, it's the most perfect way to do this type of book, when it's the same thing happening to everyone, but at the same time, we get to get everyone's like in real time reactions to what's happening to them.
Right. And I think there were a handful of characters you could kind of get behind a little more than the others in this, because this story has a lot of unlikable characters.
Oh, Don Peters. I was happiest when he died at the end. You know, King likes to keep his jerk characters, you know, lasting a long time so he can get a really good comeuppance for them. And I was glad at least that he got murdered.
It's kind of awful when you're rooting for characters to die.
Even I'm in, like, come on, when is this going to happen?
Even in a Stephen King novel, because, you know, we're so used to rooting against, or I should say, I'm so used to rooting against characters like Pennywise, or, you know, these characters that are not necessarily evil from the start, but you know that they're going to be the villains. And with this, when everything starts, you don't really have any real sense of that. And you have to kind of just realize along the way, okay, we have this character, Eve Black, who has come in. She has these supernatural abilities. She is technically a woman, but also not really in a sense. And she is like, oh, the men are just going to destroy everything. And I was like, okay.
I felt it was a super clumsy thesis statement. It's sort of like men are going to ruin it, and then it's up to the women to fix them. For a 700-page book, it felt a little too, come on, man, like a little too pat. Eve did unnerve me a bit before, like, she actually started talking, when she was just like in the back of Lila's cruiser and she was like smacking her head on the thing. That always like weirds me out when people just start committing violence against themselves. I'm like, oh, she's crazy. And I'm like, oh, she's not crazy. And this is, you know, it's the Joker thing of trying to get yourself arrested so you can, you know, mess with everyone. For what she wanted them to do, it took too long to get that across.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask you specifically was, which thing was worse? The fact that you had men going around and burning up women in the cocoons, or the fact that Eve definitely knew that this giant shootout was going to happen at the end, and one, didn't do anything about it, and two, all of the men were just like, yeah, we're going to go along with this and do it.
Because Eve isn't technically human, I guess that's less terrible, because I'm not ascribing human morality to her. When they were saying that the men were going around burning the women, I was like, this is it. Because it is, you know, King does like to do the whole, here's how horrible men can be to people.
Yeah.
It's quite a trope that he has. That was rough, especially when it's characters that you've technically met and are going through this. You know, Stephen King loves to write very anachronistic teenage dialogue and characters. Wasn't really terribly mad when that teenage kid got murdered when he was trying to assault that woman while she was sleeping. It didn't upset me more. Well, I mean, it upset me, but I think in the sense of I expected it from, is it sad to say that I expected it from the men in this book? I expected that there were going to be people to do that. It was just very, ugh. You just hope that they at least got their comeuppance. You really did. And I would have liked to have known if they did.
I agree, because setting the woman on fire in the cocoons was purposeful.
Yes. It was like an act against them, an act of aggression.
Right. They're defenseless. They can't do anything. They can't fight back. With the shootout at the prison at the end, it felt much more like an act of desperation. Like, these men felt like they had no other choice because they wanted answers. And Clint, who is the psychiatrist at the prison, he wasn't letting them get those answers. So in a way, you know, even though that shootout was absolutely terrible and you had people who had known each other for pretty much all of their lives killing each other, it felt like there was at least some reasoning behind that.
Yeah, like you could understand why they felt justified in doing it. Like it was for an end. It was to, in their minds, get the women back. Whereas the men burning the women in the cocoons was specifically to never get them back. It was like to make sure they were gone. So yeah, the and he definitely is, that's a like another King trope, is really is driving reasonable people to irrational behavior.
Right. So another question for you then is, who were your favorite characters in this?
I did write down a little list of you. I will say this, Clint was not one of my favorite characters. And we had to just spend so much time with him. There were some times I didn't mind him, but overall, I really liked Magda Dubček. I kind of just really enjoyed that old woman. She was very enjoyable. I like Jared better than I expected to. King does not usually write teen characters very well, but I really thought he was like, okay, that's a good kid with a head on his shoulders. Jeanette, I really liked from the beginning. I did not expect the, you know, where her story was going to go. I'm going to diverge just a moment. I apologize. I didn't know, and I think this is a really great thing about his book, is I had no idea that she was supposed to be Black. And when they made that a point at the end, I felt, well, if you're going to make it a point at the end, you should have made it a point at the beginning, because then I didn't understand what the issue was at the end when it becomes a sort of cops killing unarmed people argument. I mean, it didn't take away anything from it. I just really enjoyed her character from the get-go.
I feel like maybe they should have brought that up maybe when we find out why she's in jail, or even when the whole incident is happening with Don Peters, you know, like maybe he had a type and, you know, something like that, just to kind of flesh that out a little more. Because with the shooting at the end, you know, obviously you have this very tense situation that is only being made worse by, you know, people showing up and not knowing what's going on and not really trying to figure out what's going on, which is what leads to her being shot. And you just feel like that part is almost, I don't want to say it's shoehorned in because it fits with, you know, where the plot was heading.
I feel like without establishing that about her, without establishing that she was Black early on, it does feel more shoehorned in than if it had just been part of the narrative already.
Right.
Because then it feels like, oh, you're doing this to make a point, and it doesn't, I wouldn't have minded it if it came organically. I just didn't feel that it did.
Yeah. It felt a little forced in the moment. It was like, oh, now we're going to bring this up. Even though we could have brought it up like 400 pages ago.
400 pages in. It literally like right before she died. I'm like, oh, okay. Yes. Cool. Because I like to precast characters in my head. And I didn't really have anything in my mind for Jeanette. I just sort of, okay, this is, I just came to really enjoy this character. And I was like, oh, she's okay. But it felt like if it was important to King, if he was doing it to make a point, it didn't feel smooth. And his character work is usually a little smoother than that.
Anyone who has read King knows that he definitely brings current events into anything that he's writing. You know, the politics that were heavily, heavily noticed in The Dead Zone, for instance, you know, and sort of just the way he's incorporated those things over the years. It's no surprise to me that this was a topic he wanted to touch on. I don't know if this was necessarily the right, I mean, this was the right book for it. It just needed to be established earlier in the story.
And I will say, on the other hand, though, he also has a really bad track record of characterizations of Black characters, of how he chooses to the language, of how he uses slurs against them in the books. And it's sometimes you're like, dude, why did you have to, like, that it was unnecessary to have this in this book. Like, when especially he goes overboard sometimes, like I'm thinking about the Mr. Mercedes books with Jerome, I'm thinking of, you know, a lot of times where he just like peppers in the slurs out of nowhere. And I'm kind of glad in that end that we didn't get that in this. I'm like, it's nice to know that you don't always have to go back to that well, Stephen King.
Yeah, you also have Angel, who I think was a character we could have seen a little more from, because, you know, a lot of the time that we spend with any of the women in the story, these things are pretty much happening after they've gone hours and days without sleep. So we don't really get to see them in a more normal state until the very end of the book. So I think if this would have been bookended with, you know, before and after, it would have come across a little better. And, you know, I did like some things about this book. Like I said, I really did like the premise. I think there were a few things that just didn't click for me, which is why it took me so long to get into this book. And, you know, like we both said, character work is kind of what really drives King's stories. And I have not read anything else from Owen either. I think he only has a couple other books, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think he has like a collection of shorts and a novella or something like that.
Yeah, so this is a big leap from those things.
Very much so. That's why I think it's, I think the framework seems to be more Stephen with some Owen influences in terms of like plot and where things are going.
Yeah, and I was reading up on this too, and in an interview with CBC's radio show Q, he had mentioned that this idea came from Owen.
Oh, all right.
And I don't know how much of it came from Owen, because the quote was something along the lines of, you know, approached me with this dynamite idea. And I was reading it. I was like, how much of that idea was fleshed out, though?
Right, right.
Because it could have just been simply, you know, what if women fall asleep and, you know, get shrouded in cocoons and then they go from there. But, you know, one of the things that I think King has done really well over the years is taking these very grounded people and tossing them into a supernatural situation. And this is where I think that works. You know, you have this mysterious thing happening, but you don't really know what it is yet. And I did go through a lot of this book feeling like, okay, the women are in cocoons, so what's next? And it felt like it took a very long time to get there, but really, when they introduce Eve, I think it added this interesting element to the story that it really needed.
Oh, for sure. I did want to ask you, have you seen Storm of the Century?
Yes.
So that's one of my favorite King. It has a million problems, but I also felt there was a lot of parallels in this in terms of like Eve and Andre Linoge.
Okay.
And that they come to town, specifically to a small town. And like Linoge says, he does it to Little Tall because island people can keep a secret. And I think it's sort of the same thing we're seeing this happening in Dueling, because it's a small enough town where Eve can do these things and she's going to cause, you know, something globally is going to happen because of what's happening here, but people aren't really going to know the specifics and everyone's just going to sort of carry on. And it's these, you know, people that are going to have to deal with the consequences of what they did. And it's just sort of felt like that, where it's more, I'm doing this to play. Like Eve is, she didn't have to pick Dueling. She wanted to. And it's sort of like Linoge picked Little Tall. Why not? Because I believe you guys know what you're, you know, I know how I can play this situation. It sort of kind of felt like that to me.
What did you think of Eve picking Clint as sort of the champion of women?
I think Clint was like, for someone who we spent so much of the book with, I feel he is like aggressively underdeveloped. Like a lot of things, we hear a lot of things about him and that he has been through, but I'd never really felt like that ever really showed in his character. I could be, you know, this could just be the, I would say he's interesting to do it because he's a thinking man. And I think because he's a psychiatrist, that the point is to have someone who understands why people do things and to put him in a situation of having to be like facing down these people who are growing more and more irrational and pushing the boundaries of his own. What am I going to believe in? Am I going to sacrifice logic and reason to believe this insane story that, even though it's happening around the world, he like has those moments where he doesn't want to believe it. And she's like, no, but you do know this isn't just happening here. This is happening everywhere. And so he sort of is, you know, he has his own crisis of faith. But I think specifically he's only there to be the thinking person in an unnatural situation. And I was fine with it. I was never really fearful for him doing the wrong thing or dying or... He was sort of very milquetoast for me.
He was kind of the obvious choice, I feel like, just because of his position, his job title. And, you know, he's 48, so he is not quite close to retirement by any means, but he's seen a lot of things. He's talked to a lot of people. He has especially talked to a lot of the women at the prison by this point in time. And one thing I found interesting was the choice to not have a thinking person on the other side of things. You know, it was like Frank Gehry was...
He was irrational from the get-go in terms of like his anger problems.
Right. And, you know, he's an animal control officer, which seems ironic.
Because he himself is the animal?
One, that, but two, you would think he would be able to sort of, in a sense, wrangle people better. And, you know, you had Terry Coombs, who was kind of wishy-washy and not really knowing what to do once Lila fell asleep and he was sort of left as the man in charge. And, you know, it was very clear that this story was trying to be like, this is a small town. There are a lot of men who don't love it that Lila is sheriff. You know, they don't enjoy that, you know, a woman essentially beat them out for a job that I'm sure a lot of them would have taken had they been given the opportunity. But at the same time, Lila is this leader figure, and they know well enough to mind her leadership while she's awake. But then it's like, as soon as she falls asleep, yeah, it's like they don't know how to function almost.
it's like a Lord of the Flies kind of situation where all of a sudden they just become the most animalistic versions of themselves in less than a day. I do like that Terry is very much like, oh no, please, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be in charge. He's like, I'm very happy being the deputy. I don't want to do this. Oh, that poor man. I did feel bad for Terry. But he was like one of those quote unquote good men who, like, he liked Lila. He respected her. He didn't, you know, he very much admired her for the work that she was doing.
If I could, I wanted to ask you what you thought of Lila as sort of like the opposite part of Clint, of being the, you know, the quote unquote reasonable of the women.
I liked Lila as the sheriff in this story. I didn't really enjoy the storyline between her and Clint as much, because there was basically this anger coming from her this entire time because she found out that this girl in some other town had his last name, and then she spends so long thinking that he had an affair. And I was like, okay, this person is shown as very rational in her day job, and then in her marriage, it was like a complete 180, which obviously you can have characters who have, you know, a wide range of emotions and things like that, but it felt like her personality was literally being changed depending on what situation she was in.
I completely agree. There wasn't enough consistency with that. And I could buy that part of the story because I think a lot of, again, it's a King trope of having, I mean, it's a book trope of having the drama ramp up between two people right before the big thing that sort of separates them. And so I had sort of expected that it would come to a head right before if she was to fall asleep, it would happen right before she fell asleep. But yeah, it seemed almost a little too irrational, and maybe it's in terms of having it take place now, it's the confluence of thing happening upon thing, happening upon thing, happening upon thing. And it just sort of like pushes her to a point where she's like, this is the only thing that I think that I understand, right? Is that this girl looks like you in my mind, and she has your last name your name on her birth certificate. And so without even asking a question, she sort of jumps to that immediate anger. But there's not enough consistency with her throughout to really justify her being this like a strong character that I want her to be.
Yeah. And, you know, with the whole, did he have an affair, did he not have an affair thing, it's like, I understand her being mad for sure. You know, thinking that. And obviously, if Norcross is not a common last name, you know, that's a reasonable conclusion to jump to. But the fact that, you know, as sheriff, she's probably had to question a lot of people within that town and can probably tell when someone's lying or when they aren't. But it felt like she never really gave Clint an honest chance to explain the situation. And then he has to call, you know, the girl's mom, and he has to explain everything and have her talk to his wife. And then
how she knows the handshake.
Yeah. She's trying to turn Jared against him. And I was like,
oh, I didn't like that. I was like, you don't bring your son into this. Come on, Lila.
Yeah.
It's a little more mad about that than I think the anything else that she was doing. He's 16.
Which, look, people are flawed.
Yes.
It's okay for characters in books to be flawed as well, as many are in this book.
I prefer if they are.
Yes. The issue is, like you said, with the consistency, they introduce her as one type of way, you know, a rational sheriff in a leadership position in town. A lot of people respect her. Sure, some people don't, as is life. But then to have the home life situation just be a complete 180, I was like, what happened? You know, yeah, like,
completely.
If they would have showed her like slowly becoming irrational, that would have been, I think, a better way to have that happen.
Like, I get that she was getting tired. I get that it was already starting. I actually probably the scene I enjoyed most in the first half of the book was her seeing the tree for the first time. Because it did feel like, okay, here we are getting this very rational person in the midst of this, like, okay, holy shit, what is this even now? I like the teases of the tree before we got to the actual, oh, under the other side of the tree. Didn't really do much for me. But Lila's like sort of like first exposure to this larger concept of what was going on, sort of that first time really, really grabbed me. I will say that.
I want to try to pick out more things that I thought were well done in this. And I think when they introduced Michaela,
yes,
she was a character who instantly caught my attention because she was like, okay, I'm going to find out the truth. I am going to help in any way I can, basically. And she really felt like a go-getter. And I think this book maybe needed a couple more of those kinds of characters.
100%. Or more of, I'd say, you know, cut a few characters out, maybe just like bump her up a little bit.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly when she appeared in the book, but then it's like, no one really knew who she was, even though she was the warden's daughter.
And she grew up in the town. I think in the beginning, we meet her first when she's on TV because Magda sees her. And okay, it's like, yeah, you know, she's like, oh, my Mickey, you know, because her and Anton grew up together. But you'd expect more people, like these small towns, specifically in King books, they all know each other. And they're all supposed to like at least be like semi-aware of each other. And you'd think, yeah, if she was like local girl made big, you'd expect that more people would understand who she was.
And if I remember correctly, she was like going by a different last name, and that's, yes, supposedly what threw everyone off. It felt very Superman's glasses.
Yes. Like, just look at the eyes are the same. Everything else is the same. I did love her and Garth. I'm not going to lie. I thought the two of them made a lovely like pair of buddies, and I would have read like another book about the two of them. I thought Garth was a surprising character that I ended up really liking.
Yeah, the plastic surgeon, go figure.
Just like the drug addicted plastic surgeon who's like, oh, this like girl who's nice. And I like that he sort of like understands that it's not a romantic thing.
Yeah.
But I think he's just happy to have a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were some characters that definitely brought some entertaining moments. And I think Michaela was one of them. I also really liked Jared because, you know, teenagers can be hit or miss in general, not in Stephen King novels specifically, but just like you never really know if in crisis mode, whether or not a teenager will step up. And I think Jared really did step up in a way that, you know, maybe most people wouldn't expect from a teenager, even within the town setting. So it was pleasant to see his characters be given more responsibility than you would expect a teenager to either want or have.
Very much so. And I love a teen kid that feels realistic, but is also good. Like, you know, at his heart, Jared is a good kid. He's going to do dumb things. He's going to think stupid things. I like that they make a point to have him be as jealous as he is with like the little dumb things that teenagers get jealous about. It's very in character, but you know, based on everything they're doing, that at his heart, he's going to do the right thing.
Yeah. I will say Molly Ransom, also a fun character, even though she's got a pretty brief appearance. You know, she's in it for quite a bit at the beginning, and because she's 10, she kind of has all of this energy that maybe some of the adults don't have, especially her grandmother. And you're like,
yes,
oh, okay, she's going to be bouncing off the walls for a bit, and then she's going to crash hard. And that's pretty much what happened.
Uh-huh. So I have many, many nieces and nephews, and I have one who's 15 and one who's 11. And so very much I was imagining, okay, what would they be like in this situation? And when I try to think of realism in, you know, how kids are written in books, I sort of, you know, of course, go on my own experience, and I sort of think, oh, how would my niece or my nephew be in this situation? And I do like that it's a fairly realistic portrayal of what these kids are like at that age.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we're jumping around a bit here, but I want to make sure we also touch on the animals.
Oh my goodness. I literally wrote fox in my notes. It's like, of course you have a talking fox in this book, Stephen King. Of course you do.
Yeah, so these supernatural elements kind of reminded me a little of some of the stuff they did in The Dark Tower, especially with Oi.
I'm less learned in Dark Tower, I will be honest. I've only read the first two, but I've done a lot of like vague like learning about what different levels of the tower are.
Yeah, so Oi is a Billy Bumbler that just kind of ends up following the Dark Tower crew around, if you will. I don't want to give you anything that would spoil it for you, but he's basically this creature that becomes part of the pack. And, you know.
Okay. I'm looking at pictures right now.
Yeah,
okay.
And right. He can kind of say things, you know, he'll try to say people's names and things like that. So it kind of reminded me of that a little, but obviously very different situations here. And it felt like if we were to get a visual representation of the animals and the tree, you know, can't forget about the tree, it would almost feel like you'd have to have this visual that looks completely out of place from everything else.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it kind of gives you this sense of how beautiful Eve's powers can be almost.
Oh, I can imagine. Like, that was part of the joy of reading some of that stuff, is I really love when supernatural characters have that sort of, like, even when, I mean, Eve is supposed to be, you know, the moth stuff is gross to me, because moths are gross things to me. But the lushness of, like, because it's very, you know, Eve, blah, blah, it's very literal in terms of what it's trying to reference. But it's very garden, it's very, you know, it's here's the beauty that I bring to, that I can bring to the world. And here's, like, the purity of nature, that kind of thing.
But then there's also the flip side of that where, you know, you mentioned the moths, but there's also the rats.
Oh, talks to the rats. I don't like the rats.
That part felt probably the most Stephen King to me because, you know, you have like 1922 and these other stories and adaptations that sort of give off that similar imagery. And you can tell that it was like, okay, you know, maybe this was where Stephen King had his influence in the supernatural and in these rats just doing whatever Eve willed them to, basically. And
talk to them about, she like verbally speaks with them. I sort of, that's in that sense, I can imagine, you know, Owen trudging along, you know, right in this section of the book, and then Steve just sort of jumping up to him like, hey, man, what's going on? Can I write it? Can I just, well, what if like she talked to the rats right here? Like, what if? I'm going to write it. You can put it in if you want. You can just sort of imagine Steve. Yeah, you're right. He very much feels like he insisted on that.
So, yeah, I really wish I liked this book more. But for me, when I was reading through it, you know, I tend to like check my friends on Goodreads and see like who's reviewed it and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of people really like this novel. And I can see what the appeal is with this kind of story. But for me, there was just stuff that wasn't clicking the entire time. And I was reading it and I was probably like 100 or 200 pages in. And I was like, okay, something else needs to happen. Because at that point, I wasn't really caring about enough characters. I do think the end kind of saves it a little, but
agreed.
Peter, do you have anything else you want to bring up? There's obviously some great imagery that this book brings about, but it just fell flat for me in the end.
Overall, yes. I will say, I'm going to jump on the agreement train of there of at least having the fact that we have sort of like essentially a 20-page epilogue is more than I expected from this book. I just remember my fury at Under the Dome ending as quickly as it did and it being fucking aliens. It just sort of, I was very glad that we at least got some time with these people when they were back.
Yeah.
I will say I have marked this page because I knew as I was reading, I'm like, I'm going to have to bring this up. On page 454, I just have this one tiny, tiny little chunk of a paragraph when Lila is exploring the crumbled prison in our place. And she's going through and the line just says, "You always, 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 always fall from the topmost grid of the ceiling that you're using for a ladder in the hall of the maximum security prison that has gone sliding down the unstable remains of a former coal mountain." And to me, that just sounded like, you know what? Yes, I do like that there's a tiny bit of, she's realizing that she's doing an insane thing.
Yeah.
and that just sort of made me chuckle. Other than that, you're right. There's just one too many things happening. Either we're meeting new characters 100 pages before the end, and this is a book where you're already 400 pages in thinking, how in the hell is there 300 more pages of this? Like, what else is going to happen? And I don't think enough justified that. You're very right in that there's just, you just don't care about these people that much to want to spend this much time with them. And I'm never going to read this book again. I don't think I ever will read this book again.
Yeah. One of the things I really love about a lot of King novels is he hits you with this gut punch at some point throughout his novels a lot of the time. And this didn't feel like it had that. I guess they were hoping that it would be Lila shooting Jeanette, but
it happens so late and it's not the buildup that they want isn't justified or like it should matter more.
There's no consequence to it.
Exactly. Cause they bury her and they come back and it's okay. Lila has to deal with what she did, but she's the only one really. And I like, well, Ellen sends the money to the son and then, you know, what's the terribly named daughter? Nana.
Nana, yeah.
12-year-old named Nana. It's like, Steven, come on with your names.
It took me so long to realize they were talking about a child.
Yeah, she was a child, yes. I was like, this is a terrible name for a child.
I was like, is this Frank's mother?
Oh, I did. I enjoyed the tiny little bit of that at the end, like her becoming, you know, sort of pen pals and eventual, I guess, dating Jeanette's daughter or Jeanette's son. And so there's like that, it's like, I guess it's like a follow-up, but it doesn't feel like a consequence. And if he'd meant to do that, it sort of felt like in the beginning when he did the "nevertheless, she persisted" quote. I'm like, but did you just put that in there because it was a thing that just happened? Or did you mean that to be a thesis for the story? Because I really don't feel at the end of the day, they understood what their thesis was and didn't really have a strong enough follow through to really make me remember this book in another 10 years.
Yeah, this is one I probably won't end up revisiting either, just because, one, I'm definitely going to need a break when I'm done with this.
Yes.
And two, it wasn't enough to make me be like, okay, maybe I just missed something on the first read. And like I said, if people love this book, fantastic. I definitely see why people would like it. But for me, you know, to go to ratings here, I ended up giving this a 2 out of 5.
I would probably do like 2 or 2.5. Yeah.
I felt guilty doing it because I really wanted to like this one once I realized what the premise was, but then I was like, it just didn't come together for me.
There's when I think of a rating of a book, I think about rereadability. I like to buy books when I know that I'm going to like pick them off my shelf at any given moment. And like with King specifically, I, as right before this, I had read Needful Things, then I read Dolores Claiborne as sort of like my palate cleanser, and then I read this. And it's tough to read better books when you're following it up with a book that you're like, okay, it doesn't really live up. And I think, you know, his best character work, I can't say it's behind him because I really like a lot of the stuff in the Mr. Mercedes series, but like Clint Norcross is not Alan Pangborn and Evie is not Leland Gaunt. Like some of these things that he's trying to do, you've done them already. Give me something different, because you can't go back to your greatest hits when you're not going to invest in them as strongly as you did back in the day.
Yeah. I feel like if we would have just been hit with some of the before times, you know, maybe that's what would have made this come together for both of us. But Peter, any final thoughts here?
I would say a final thought. I was offended at how many times in this book I had to read the phrase Claudia the Dynamite Badia. I'm like, you don't pronounce Claudia. I don't understand, Stephen King. What are you doing with this? I'll leave it with that.
Great note to end on. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about Sleeping Beauties.
Thank you, Deanna. This is lovely.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.